I'm creating an MP3 of this talk. If any of you would like a copy of the MP3, just give me your business cards and I'll be glad to email you the MP3. What I'm going to do is, I'm just, no big deal, just going to tell you three simple stories of my life and what it means to me and what it potentially could mean to you. At any point, please feel free to interrupt with questions. Let's not wait till the end of the program. The first simple story really has to do with fear, exhilaration, and the exit strategy. How many of you have your exit strategies clearly defined for your practice? Okay, just a couple of you. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my career and my exit strategies. Like Alan, my training is organization development. Like Alan, I was with a large global consulting firm. And my area of expertise was executive compensation and organization development. And then I was asked, since I was a psychologist, and would I be interested in getting involved with something called outplacement? I said, well, that sounds very interesting. Again, this is 1978. And it was a relatively new concept. And so this company wanted to get involved in the outplacement industry. And so I met the person who was going to be the CEO of this outplacement firm, and he said, you know, I'm going to be here for 3 years and I'm going to leave, and then you can become the CEO. Oh, I said, that's great. He says, well, what I'd like you to do is, why don't you sketch out your vision for what you would like to see from this outplacement firm? So I created a plan, and the plan was called How to Fire a Friend. I said, companies are in this situation where they've got long-term employees who've really done a terrific job of helping the company get to the point where basically the company's outgrown them. And our value proposition is, we're going to help leaders feel good about doing terrible things to people, because we'll take care of those employees. You can still fire somebody and feel like a mensch. Basically, that was it. So I present that to the CEO, and he looks at me and says, Larry, you really don't understand. What we really want to do is, we want to sell 2-day group job search programs to Fortune 500 companies at, you know, X dollars a day, and put them through a training program and be done with it. And I was like, you know, 26, 27, I was full of myself. I said, well, fine, that's not what I want to do. And so with a lot of chutzpah, I quit. And with a lot of balls, I opened up an office directly across the street, of a hallway in the same building on the same floor, the company that I built. And that's how we started our company. It was December of 1979. And there were two things going on for me at the time: exhilaration and panic. Does that sound familiar? How many went through this? Exhilaration, because I was finally doing what I think God had put me on earth for, which was be the master of my own destiny, not somebody else's employees. This is really what I wanted to do. So that was the exhilaration part. The panic was that I'd read the business books, and I realized, I knew that 70% of new businesses that start up fail within 5 years. And I was feeling both of these things at the same time. And it informed just about every decision that I made. So the first question is, what was I going to do? Well, the framework was what my company had rejected, which was How to Fire a Friend. That's what we were going to do. So I found one of the biggest decisions that I turned out that I ever made was the decision on printing my first business card. I wish I had been with you, Ken. Because the first question they asked me is, what are you going to call the company? And again, the exhilaration part took over. This is my company. It's about me. So I was going to call it Stibel Peabody Associates. And Peabody was my partner and my wife. So it was going to be Stibel Peabody Associates. Then the issue was, okay, what's the tagline? And even even an unexperienced 27-year-old, I realize that for a professional service firm, the tagline on the business cards basically is your strategic plan. Because it informs what you will not do. I said, well, am I going to say I'm a human resource, consulting? That's too vague. Am I going to say we're a management consultant? No, that's too vague. Am I going to say we're outplacement consultants? I said, you know, that's where the fear took over. I said, I don't want to put all my bets in outplacement because one of the great things about me is I create a facade that I'm very confident. That comes from being tall and having acting. But, you know, privately, I had no idea whether this was going to work. So there was the exhilaration and the panic, So I wanted to hedge my bets. So we called, the first business card was, we are consultants in management transitions, which I thought was a really cool way to say it. What it meant was, you need something in executive compensation, not us. You want a large-scale organization development thing that's going to involve multi-levels of organizations, that's not us. You're going to fire 10% of your employees and put them through a two-day workshop, that's not us. On the other hand, if you need some coaching for a senior person, that's us. You need some recruiting for a senior person, that's us. You need outplacement for a senior person, that's us. As a matter of fact, in 1997, we totally revised our business card. And in 1979, it said we are consultants in management transitions. And today, we call ourselves specialists in smooth leadership change. So when you think about it, we haven't really changed much. But the real smart thing, what I did, but I did it out of a sense of panic and fear and uncertainty because I didn't want to hedge my bets, was I instinctively stayed away from a functional definition. You know, I'm an IT consultant. I'm an HR consultant. I didn't want to do that. I focused on a problem. So today the problem is, if you're going to change leadership, it's got to be done smoothly. I'm your guy. If you don't care, I'm not your guy. So when times were good, our revenue model was like 33-33-33. 33% executive outplacement, 33% coaching, 33% retained search. Mostly CEO, VPs of HR, CFOs. Then when the economy just hit when the economy tanked in 2008, everything stopped for a while, and then by 2009, we were 100% outplacement. And then 2010, we were 100% outplacement. Then by the end of 2010, the mix started changing, and now I'm seeing more coaching, more calls for search. So again, by defining ourselves by a theme as opposed to a function, it gave us maneuverability, and I was correct. The business card basically defined the strategy of the firm for the last 32 years. That's the good news. The bad news is that my obsession with my self-confidence and Stibel Peabody also created kind of a thing where the marketing of Stibel Peabody was really about the marketing of Larry Stibel. Larry Stibel would give speeches, Larry Stibel would give articles. It was really about Larry Stibel. And indeed, we weren't selling products, we were selling services that Larry Stibel liked to do. And if you go on the web, it's very Larry Stibel-centric. It was an expression of me. Stibel Peabody is an extension of me. If I make a proposal and somebody doesn't buy, I take it personally. It's me. And there was no exit strategy. And one message I'd like to give you is that you know, when the Supreme Court refuses to hear a case, that's a decision. When you don't have an exit strategy, you made a decision about your exit strategy. Now, what are the exit strategies that you can have in your business? Well, one exit strategy is no exit. In other words, we have a lifestyle business, we'll continue to do it, and then, you know, God forbid we get injured, we can't work anymore, or we decide to retire, we close out the lights, the lease is up, it's out. Another exit strategy is I'm here until I get hired by a company. And then when that gig is up, I'll go back to the consulting. I'm seeing that very frequently with people that I know. They go like this and like that. And it is a useful model. The consulting becomes the touch point in your professional life. Then one of your clients, you know, wants you full time and you move there. But you know you're going to do that for a few years and then you move back. So and you do that until you decide you can't work anymore or you don't want to work anymore. A third exit strategy is until you get hired by a larger player in your industry. Obviously, I wasn't thinking about that at all. Every decision I was making at Steibel Peabody was a stupid decision from that point of view. First of all, I wasn't selling any products. Everything was an idiosyncratic service built around Larry Steibel. The website, the marketing plan was so Larry Steibel-centric, if Larry Steibel wasn't there to push it, there is no Steibel Peabody. So how could you sell that to somebody else? And then finally, the last strategy, which I wasn't even in the cards, which was to become a public company. I wasn't even thinking along those lines. Now, the interesting thing that happened with Steibel Peabody is that because we're dealing with senior level executives, we kept doing work at board levels, particularly when we were doing CEO searches. And then the board started asking us to do board searches. So we said, well, you know, maybe we ought to have a separate company just for the board work that we're doing. So it doesn't conflict with Steibel Peabody, which still has the outplacement and career piece. Maybe we need to separate. So we created a separate company. But this time, I wasn't afraid. And this time, I felt more confident. So I didn't have the fear, and I didn't have. I was actually much more methodical about what I was doing than when I founded Steibel Peabody. So in 2001, we founded Board Options. So number one is my name. Marianne's name is not anywhere near there. Indeed, if you go to the website Board Options, our name isn't even on there at all. It's very hard to find out, you know, who we are. It's about the company. Third is we productized everything that we do. For example, we sell board of director retained searches. We have another company another product called Board Options Fellows, where as part of a CEO succession program, a company comes to us with some of their high potentials, asks us to help their high potentials get on boards of directors. And then once they do, we coach them for a year. Now, this is consistent with Alan's idea. Steibel Peabody is really based on fee for service, an hourly rate. Board Options, on the other hand, is retainer-based, so it's retained search. Also, the Board Options Fellowship Program is we get a small fee for getting to know the person. We get a really whopping big fee once we place them on a board, so it's a different model. And then we get a third retainer fee for coaching them for a year on governance issues. So it's much more along the lines of what Alan was talking about, which is moving towards a value-based service. But the idea of Board Options is not making a mistake that I did at Steibel Peabody. It's not about Larry Steibel. It's not about service, it's about products. It's about retainer relationships. It's about success fees. And so I'm liking the way that is flowing. Any questions or reactions? Does that ring any bells for any of you in terms of your businesses or think about what you might want to do with your businesses? Anybody?
Yeah, I liked your honesty about the name. You decided to do it differently for the new products, and you invented those new products around what your client was asking for that you didn't do before.
Right. Yeah. And Ken?
15 years ago or so, you and I used to compete.
Yes.
And you were telling me about your exit plan.
Yep.
Well, I bought the firm of a competitor of yours.
Yes.
And that was his exit plan.
That you had the ingenue, right.
Bring him up through the thing,
yep.
For a period of time, buy the thing out of earnings, etc.
Right.
And he retired. So that's that took place in 1989. One way to do it.
And he did it.
Yes.
And he was thinking along those lines, and I wasn't even thinking of those lines. I mean, that was like, I wasn't even thinking of those lines, but I am thinking along those lines now. Maybe partially it's age, but I also think it's also experience.
Right.
But I think here's the lesson. For those of you who are earlier in your professional lives as consultants, of course you're afraid. And of course it's an exhilarating ride to be the captain of your own destiny. But just look beyond that, because fear and exhilaration can make you forget about you do need an exit strategy, because if you don't have an exit strategy, that is the exit strategy. The default is it's a lifestyle business, and when you get disabled, when you retire, that's the end of your business.
Is Stylo Peabody a lifestyle business, or is it just the two of you?
It's we have a number of people who assist us, mm-hmm. So we can build up. But it really is more or less the two of us, and we have all sorts of affiliations.
So what is the exit? If somebody was to buy it, I think
Stibel Peabody is a lifestyle business.
Okay, so that goes away.
It would go away. Board Options is specifically designed to be acquired.
But it's still just you.
Yeah, but it doesn't require Larry Stibel to do it.
It's
productized. Much more web-based. Larry Stibel isn't required to drive Board Options. Somebody else could do that.
Can you talk about some of the details that are built into the design of Board Options that make it different from Larry Stibel, define the exit plan?
On the website,
or
as a business, certainly Stibel Peabody is really based around what I like to do, and I like to work with senior level executives. Whether I'm helping them with their careers, like I was with Martha, and helping them redefine their careers, or whether I'm recruiting, I like to work with bright, capable senior level people. I have a short attention span. I tend to be goal-oriented, so I like projects that have clear goals. That's why I was such a lousy therapist. Somebody said, I want to be happy. Oh, I said, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't deal with that. Board Options is much more productized. There is, when we give a proposal for a retained search for a board, there's step by step about what everything is going to happen, and it doesn't have to be Larry Stibel to do the steps, and somebody else could be trained to do the steps. The Board Options Fellows program, at this point, does require somebody with Larry Stibel's network to pull off, but it could be done without it, particularly when you go to the Board Options website. We have something called the Board of Directors Talent Bank. We have 450 very good quality people who are on boards of directors, and when we're selling search, it's not about Larry Stibel. I bring my iPad and I say, "You're concerned if we don't have the network to do this search for you? Here." Go to Board Options, go to the Board of Directors Talent Bank, do a keyword search on what you're interested in. That's my network. You can do a search on my network. You won't get the names, but you'll get the code numbers of people. So it's much more web focused. The other thing that we do is every month we have a program, and Tom has spoken at that program, and Martha's spoken at it, on corporate governance. And then we create MP3 files, and then we distribute the MP3 files to 500 board members around the United States. So everything is web-based, and it's not about Larry Stibel. So I feel much better that this is, from a business point of view, it's a much more thoughtful product that was not done under conditions of fear.
Sounds like you made a decision to not have employees early on as well.
One of the things I learned about myself is I'm the worst manager that I know. I'm extraordinarily impatient. I can get good and highly qualified and very good motivated people to come in as 1099s, you know, people like yourself. And I would rather sell. I'm a good salesperson. I'm a good writer. I'm a good presenter. I'm a lousy manager. So one of the nice things about consulting is I can play to my strengths. I mean, one of the great things about our profession is it can be eminently malleable to play to our strengths. Yeah, I had a staff, I had a big office, and I remember being in the fetal position at 2 a.m. in my living room because I realized we could go bankrupt and we didn't have the money for the lease, and I didn't know what to do. I said, I'm never going to do that again. Martha was a client of mine, and I whipped her with the model, minimize your fixed costs, maximize your variable costs.
I have to tell you, and this is true, and he didn't pay me to say this, but that was the best advice that I had almost ever gotten, because I too changed my business model, and at one point I wanted to be this big, you know, Fortune 10 company or something and all these employees. But Larry said to me, you know, you really need to keep your overhead down as much as possible. Think about subcontractors, think about what you're doing, because a lot of us do build up all these staff, and then you end up paying other people, and you really, because of cash flow, which is so difficult with small businesses, you end up like looking, you know, almost having your house foreclosed on or something. So that piece of advice really, really, really was helpful to me. And the more that you can use other people with subcontracting type things or you know, just use their services when you need them, I think the better off you are.
Let me move to my second story, which, and I'll bounce off what Alan was saying. He used the term wholesale versus retail. And he said that when he began his career, he was in the wholesale business, or what I would say B2B. And today he's in the retail business, or what I would say B2C. So I'm going to give you three choices. You're in the wholesale business, you're in the retail business, or you're both at the same time. So those are the three choices. Wholesale, retail, B2B, B2C, or both. How many of you would define yourself as primarily business to business? Vast majority of everybody in the room. How many of you would define yourself primarily as business to consumer? Nobody. How many would define yourself as both at the same time? Two. Okay. So I'll tell you my story, and then we'll take a vote again. I'm very proud that one of my best and longest term clients is a company called State Street. And when I first got to State Street, it was in another building and it had a sign that says State Street Bank. And I remember saying, I don't get it. You're State Street Bank, but I don't see any, you know, stores, you know. And they said, no. We're not B2C, we're B2B. We only work with institutions. We don't work with individuals. Ah, I get it. B2B, wholesale. I got it. Well, 2 weeks ago, the president of State Street was at a breakfast meeting at the Boston Chamber of Commerce. Anybody go to that program? So he was talking about that State Street is an individual. And I never heard of that word, individual. And he said, what State Street is yes, we sell we are an institution that sells to other institutions. But now, increasingly, we have individuals who are wealthy, and they come to us for financial counseling and investment advice, and we'll craft products for individuals. So we're no longer B2B, we're not B2C, we're individual. I said, what a cool word, individual. That afternoon, I swear to God, same day, I'm consulting with the board of directors of a large physician practice organization. And the question that we're trying to wrestle with is, how do we evaluate the performance of the CEO? What should the CEO be doing? And the CEO spends most of his time representing this large physician practice with the people that count. The people that count are the payers, the HMOs. The people that count are the hospitals. In other words, it's an institution. And the physicians were saying, you know, he doesn't understand our business. It's changed. Yes, in the past, we worked with people called patients. But really, we're paid for by insurance companies. And what happens at the insurance company levels is terribly important. So he was right. That's where the action is. But where healthcare is going is that employers are going to throw more of the cost of healthcare onto their employees. Where healthcare is going is that more of the decision making is going to be thrown back to the individual by the HMO. Oh, you want an appendectomy, and you want to go to Mass General. That's fine. It's going to cost you this. On the other hand, if you go to your local community hospital, it's going to go here. Do you think that's worth it? Well, we've got a website for you, and you can look at survival rates for appendectomies at the two hospitals, and you can make your own decision. And they're saying, our future is no longer just with the institutions. We've also got to market to the individuals. We've got to convince the individuals they're going to get as good a service with us as they would with Mass General. And I'm saying to myself, Instavidual. So then I went and looked at, does anybody own Instavidual.com? I do. My third business. Think about your business. Are you B2B, B2C, or both? Let me give you an example. Martha. Martha was Vice President of Human Resources at a Harvard teaching hospital. Very impressive, as she said. I got paid by that hospital to provide services for Martha. I could say to anybody that hospital was my client. But the relationship was with Martha. It really wasn't with the hospital. And so I kept the relationship with Martha, and as Martha moved in her career, I moved with Martha. We continued the relationship. So am I B2B or B2C? I think I'm an individual. Are you an individual? And then what are the implications?
Talk about the referral piece too, because that's important too, as you're following someone else in their career and moving on.
Yeah, I mean, we're always helping each other.
That's right. So I've sent business his way.
Right.
And he sent business my way. And, you know, you've got to be a little careful with that, who you, you know, take into your circles. But I know him extremely well, and I know he's great at what he does, and I will feel confident, you know, giving that business to him.
I got a wonderful referral from Tom a couple of years ago with a large life sciences company. And we met some wonderful people in that large life sciences company. And I could say to anybody, this large life sciences company is a client of mine. B2B. I swear to God, I'm a B2B guy. Guess what? That company has been sold. There's nobody in that company that I know. They're listed on my website as a client. I can't even call anybody there anymore. But I still know Tom. Am I B2B or B2C? I would argue I'm both. What's the implications about that? I'll tell you what one of the implications for me is, in theory, companies don't die. In theory, they should go on forever. In theory, individuals do die. They do get old. And so I need to begin to diversify my individual relationships by generations. See, when I was young and just starting out my career, you know, networking was actually pretty simple. All I needed to do was figure out who are the people who are high potential, who are like my age and 5 years older than me, and hitch my wagon to them. Does this sound familiar? Is this something that you did, right? And you know, it was actually pretty easy to do. You know, Martha and I did that because we were going through similar life situations at the time, and so you become friends very easily. At my age now, that's hard to do because people who are my age and older are thinking about retirement. And if I keep hitching my wagon to that age group, I'm going to really go off a cliff. So what I need to do now is think about this from a demographic point of view, which has been Martha's point. I'm now executive in residence at the Sawyer Business School at Suffolk University. You're executive in residence at Boston University. That's a very deliberate act on my part. It's a very cold, calculating business decision. I want to be around 20 to 30-year-old people. And I can't do that as board options because that is not a good institutional platform to meet young people. I can do it as Professor Stiebel. So I'm an individual.
Yes? It strikes me that you're doing business with people your age who are now retiring and they're gone is B to G.
Yeah. So, all right, so let me ask the question again. Same question I asked before. Three options. How many of you are B to B? How many of you are B to C? And how many of you are both at the same time? So how many of you using that are B to B? How many are B to C? How many are both at the same time? Okay. So think about the implications in your businesses.
I also think it's interesting because I've made a lot of transition like you
have. Yeah.
And I was always very much B2C and doing consulting, and that now most of my clients, I'm consulting to consultants.
Right.
So it's changed very much. But the expertise that I brought in the work that I did with companies, basically I consult with my clients, I'm consulting with their clients, and it broadens the whole scope. And as we get grayer, it's a terrific model to use, but it also gives you the ability of kind of going on a lot of different levels. And mm-hmm. some of my B2B clients are referring me to consumers, some of my consumer clients are referring me to business.
Right.
And it actually makes for much more interesting business that's less dependent on me, but also lets me do what I like doing the most. Which I think is
important. And you were one of the few people that did raise your hand when you defined yourself as an individual business at the beginning. And I do think it does...
Does it fight you for the domain name?
No, you can pay me for the domain name. my last story is an article that I read and started obsessing about. And if anybody would like a copy of the article, again, give me your business cards and scratch newspaper article or write the word Ford. Here's the article that I was obsessed about. Turns out that Ford Motor Corporation will not be able to offer black as a color for Ford products this fall. They will not be able to offer the color red. They will not be able to offer metallic blue, which is a very popular color. Can you imagine buying a big old ass Ford truck, then you can't get a black? They can't do that.
It used to be their only color.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it used to say you can get any good. They can't do black. Why can't they do black? Because they got a sole source contract with a paint manufacturing company in Japan. And after the earthquake and after the tsunami and after the radiation, that plant is shut down. It's going to open up again, but at least for now, you can't get a black Ford truck. You can't get a metallic blue car. You can't get a red Ford car. And I said, there's something about this story. there's something about this story. And then I said, I understand why I'm obsessed about it. Because I do work with boards of directors. And you know what I find boards of directors are obsessed with? Risk management. Risk management. Risk management. You know, they really are okay if you don't get the cheapest contract. But they're really not okay if you violated basic risk management. Because what really keeps them up at night is they do not want to be on page one of the Boston Globe. It's about risk management. That's about, you know, that was the thing I was talking about after 9/11, risk management. That's the thing, that was the problem that created the financial meltdown, risk management. But what about when I'm with operating managers at the middle management? Are they obsessed with risk management? No, they're obsessed with cutting costs. So there's a gap that I am seeing between the obsession in the board levels and the obsession of the middle management. And I'm thinking, wait a second. This is what happened to BP oil spill. The board of directors of BP, believe me, were obsessed with risk management. They took that very seriously. But the middle management operating level, they're obsessed with saving money. And the gap between that created that problem. Ford was looking for a sole source contract for all their black paint around the world. Sole source contracts is a trade-off. Flexibility versus cost and ease of administration. How many of you have ever lost business because of sole source contracts that somebody else had? Anybody lost business for that? You have? Anybody else? Okay. I think, why do we lose business as consultants? How do we lose business? I think we lose business for three reasons. The first and most important reason is sloth, S-L-O-T-H. The customer, whether it's an individual or a company, just decides to take no action, either because they decide it's not important enough, they don't want to spend the money, or they say, I can do this myself. So sloth is your biggest, absolutely your biggest competitor. The second competitors would be other consultants that are offering similar services to yours. But your third biggest competitor is the ideology of sole source contracting. That if we went with a big, humongous company that gave us a cheap price, our boss is going to be pleased with us, and we will have career stability, and everything's going to be happy. And part of us as independent sole proprietors in consulting, we need to sort of engage in a battle that questions the legitimacy of that idea. And that's why I think the article about Ford is so important, and why I'd love for you to have the article so that you can use that with your clients. Because I think sole source contract is actually the following. It's a trade-off of you're giving up on flexibility and you're increasing your risks in return for the perception that the cost will be less expensive and easier to administer. And that's what the article of Ford is. It's about risk management. And I don't see enough middle managers taking that into account. Can anybody relate to this?
Yeah, I mean, that's in my wheelhouse, if you will, risk management. But that was an incomplete risk management plan they had. It wasn't just from what the information you give me, right?
Because
you should have taken, as part of your what-if analysis, that into the thing. You might have another one where you just have a huge delay, but you still get the cost for a small, you know,
But my point is,
yeah,
it wasn't done.
Right.
And this is, you know, if we were talking about Stiebel Peabody,
yeah,
you could easily say, well, it's a small company and he's not terribly sophisticated. We're talking about Ford.
Yeah. No, I did that with a huge financial institution in London, and all their backup stuff was like 7 miles away. And this is after I talked to him about okay, now what do you do with your backup? Is it on a different grid? I'm thinking, you know.
Right.
All this stuff, so they don't go down and they say, oh, it's 7 miles away.
My point is that the middle management of America is not thinking about risk management enough. I think that's what you would say. But the boards certainly are.
Yeah.
And we need to make them aware about that.
I guess when you talk about the risk management, they certainly had that problem at hand. But even with the storms we had around here this winter, nobody's prepared for to go out and buy roof breaks and things like that. We've been talking to our clients about how to manage that.
But we need to engage our clients in the discussion about sole source contracts and the issue about risk management. And again, depending on your relationship with the individual that you're dealing with, you can also talk about risk management for your career. If you decide to go down the road of sole source contracts, what it means is that you're saying that if I know how to set my speed dial for Mercer for HR consulting, for Korn Ferry for search, and for IBM for computer services, I'm going to achieve a great deal of respect in my company. And I'm trying to say to people, no. If people understand you've set your speed dial to the usual suspects, you're setting yourself up to be replaced. You've turned yourself into a commodity, because anybody can do that. Anybody can set their speed dial to that. The difference between a commodity player and a real high-value player in a company is the person takes the time to know who's best in breed in a particular area that I need. So let's say in the area of executive compensation, yeah, I could use Mercer, but for Salesforce compensation for this particular industry, there's a guy in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who works out of his home, who's perfect, and charges one-third the rate of Mercer. Somebody who knows that has got value to their company. And I think there's an insufficient attention being paid to that. We compete with sole source contracts. We, as small individual practices, will find it hard to compete in that environment.
So there's a little bit of a compare and contrast. I'm just thinking about one of the nonprofits I work with now, where every time it's time to think about updating their strategy or tighten the business plan as they bring the board, they come back to me. I've worked with them on and off since 2004.
Right.
I don't want them to think about, gee, there's probably a couple other folks that they ought to think about. I have had, when they had a very specific board issue, I recommended someone else who specializes it,
right,
and had nothing to do with that project. And so they came back to me again for the current plan.
Yeah, this is a, if you are, well.
It's not the same point.
It is. It's two sides of the same coin.
Right.
I love to get sole source contracts. And if I got them, I give you a good reason why you should continue with that. I never said I wasn't a hypocrite. But if I'm on the other side of the coin and I'm not getting the sole source contracts, well, then I want to fight it. I want to fight the logic behind it.
Right.
Larry, I've got two actual cases that there are variations of that. One in which case is a construction company, small construction company, average job, $400,000. And they were trying to get the business off this huge player in the area. And they were locked in by this national firm. Well, the client wanted to put a portico on the front of their entrance. And the big company didn't want to do it. But they didn't want to lose their customer. They didn't want to let the little guy in. So they engaged him to work for them to do the work. And in that way, he got into that account, and he did a lot of other $200,000 jobs, which were too small for the big deal.
Sure. Sure.
So there may be an analog there.
Any other questions, reactions? I'll give you one more story, and then I'm through. I was providing executive level outplacement for a mutual fund manager, and I worked with him, and then he got a job with another mutual fund and was making something like $1.5 million base salary, and with a bonus potential, he could be company could be taking home like $4 million. And he must have seen something in my face. And he said, you know, this is really good, and I appreciate all your help, but you're the one that I'm really jealous of. And I go, you want to come at me again? Why are you jealous of me? He says, you know, this money is great, but I can only make this money in a large financial institution. And if I couldn't do this on my own. I have to be working in a large financial. So I've got to take the money now while I can, squirrel it away, and then someday I'm going to do what is it I really want to do. Whereas you don't need a large institution to have a pretty good life. And you're nicely diversified that there's no one client that could destroy your business if you. And you seem to like what you're doing. And you don't need to do what I'm doing, which is squirrel all the money away, and then I'll do what I really like to do. Sounds like you're doing it right now. And I said, yeah, that's right. And I think all of you who are in this room, who are independent consultants, are blessed. As Alan said, quite accurately, the whole concept of retirement is just out of the window. And then as you begin to think about the new definitions of what the next 20 years of your life is going to be like, it probably won't be full-time work inside the bowels of an organization that loves you and admires you and will take care of you for the rest of your life. It'll probably be some version of what you're doing right now. And as long as what you're doing is something that involves you, gets you some money, makes you happy, and you feel you're making a contribution to the world, hey, it's a great profession to be in. So, thank you very much. Again, give me your business cards if you want a copy of the MP3. Just put MP3 on there. And if you want a copy of the newspaper article about Ford, just write the word Ford, and then I'll send it to you. Thank you.
I would add something. If you do any kind of coaching, ask Larry for the article on how to use my coach, or what's it titled?
How to use a coach, yeah.
How to use a coach. How to use an executive coach. I've sent it to all my senior clients. Just out of the blue, a couple of weeks ago, I get this article from Larry. Take a look at this. You know, why didn't I?